Scotty.
And play! Come together on a Windows 11 PC.
And for a limited time, college students get...
the best of both worlds.
Get the Unreal College Deal. Everything you need to study and play with select Windows 11 PCs. Eligible students get a year of Microsoft 365 Premium and a year of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate with a custom color Xbox wireless controller. Learn more at windows.com/student offer. While supplies last, ends June 30th. Terms at aka.ms/college PC.
This episode is brought to you by Prime. Obsession is in session. And this summer, Prime Originals have everything you want. Steamy romances, irresistible love stories, and the book-to-screen favorites you've already read twice. Off Campus, Elle, Every Year After, The Love Hypothesis, Sterling Point, and more. Slow burns, second chances, chemistry you can feel through the screen. Your next obsession is waiting. Watch only on Prime.
Hello and welcome to the Principal Liner Notes podcast. This is the final episode of our special summer season sojourn jaunt, if you will. I'm Sean Gaylord, and I am very grateful to have two people that are not only past guests on Principal Liner Notes podcast, but they are also folks whom I consider to be friends, thought partners, and bandmates. So very much welcome. You're not seeing double or triple. There's nothing wrong with your podcast platform. We have two guests, so to speak, and our purpose is to talk about a wonderful new book that has been a long time in coming by Elizabeth Dampf. Am I cut out for this? An Educational Leader's Guide to Navigating Self-Doubt. And Lauren is holding up a copy, and we'll put all the links in the show notes as such. But Lauren Kaufman, as you know, is a returning guest. She is the unofficial executive producer of the podcast, and she is helping me in this just great conversation that we've already started with Elizabeth Dampf. So great to bring Chicago and New York together in the same episode.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Sean. I'm so happy to be here, and hello to everyone from the Windy City.
Yes, I echo those sentiments. And like I said before, when we were chatting pre-recording, I'm sitting here in complete awe of both Elizabeth and Sean. I'm such a big fan of you both. And you have been such an inspiration, not only to me, but the greater educational community. And everything you write is so authentic and meaningful and intentional. And not only does it resonate deeply with me, but it helps inspire my thinking because I love to write as well. So, and I think one of the things that brought us together today was my appreciation for both of your writing, but we're talking about Elizabeth today because this book I read in 2 days flat. Sean had recommended it to me. I followed you on ASCD, your blogging. I think your writing is so authentic, and you say what every leader and educator is thinking, but might be afraid to say out loud. So that always resonates deeply. And because I read that in 2 days flat, I was inspired to write a blog post called Naming the Narrative.
Ready to soundtrack your summer? With Red Bull Summer All Day Play, you choose a playlist that fits your summer vibe the best. Are you a festival fanatic, a deep end DJ, a road dog, or a trail mixer? Just add a song to your chosen playlist and put your summer on track. Red Bull Summer All Day Play. Red Bull gives you wings. Visit redbull.com/brightsummerahead to learn more. See you this summer.
Which I wrote pretty quickly. It was easy for me to do that after writing this, which was all around self-doubt. And it resonated with so many more people than I thought it would. Because as I was saying pre-recording, when I write every week. I never know what's going to resonate with others. But your work, the quotes I embedded, my own self-reflection, I see that it's getting shared widely. Mm-hmm. And I know that a lot of people in my professional learning network have ordered your book, Elizabeth. So I highly recommend it to all.
Thank you. I mean, honestly, I think the word that stood out to me from your reflection was fear. I think that there is so much fear out there, particularly around our sense of self and our sense of self-doubt. So, am I good enough? Looking at what's going on in education and in the world at large, am I capable of confronting it? And if I say something, does that make me incapable? And if I'm vulnerable, will people automatically assume that I can't do this, or, remove me from my position or come after me somehow? And when we give into that fear, I think we are naturally isolating, right? We're saying, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to write about it. I'm not going to even acknowledge it because I'm so afraid that I'm going to pull back. I'm going to withdraw and I'm going to close myself basically in my own little silo. And I think that that is just one of the worst things we can do, right? It makes the self-doubt even worse. And I think it makes our own work less connected, less authentic, less effective overall. So for me, combating fear has been one of the biggest journeys of my own personal writing, and also, I guess, the biggest goal behind the book.
That's pretty powerful. And, as I reflect upon the book, I as I was reading this, there was several things that were happening for me. One, the book is very therapeutic. As someone, who is in therapy, as someone, who has really kind of had to been forced. My health forced me to face self-doubt in a way that I don't wish upon anybody, and I'm very glad to be standing and alive and all of those things. But I guess I kept going back to why. Why is it that leaders go down that path? It's something that I've been exploring for almost 2 years now, as I'm kind of getting out of that kind of valley of self-doubt. And I try to put a label on it. I'm trying to get to a root of it. I don't know if it's this kind of myth about leadership, school leadership in particular, which is perpetuated and amplified in social media, or is it the state of education today and all of the hills and mountains that schools and school communities have to climb? I don't know. So I guess that would probably be kind of my first question for you, Elizabeth, is why is it that and again, you write so eloquently about it in the book, but why does this happen? Why is this manifesting itself?
Well, I think it starts with what leaders are expected to project in order to inspire other people. And I think that some of this is just a real phenomenon of leadership. If I express confidence in our plan or in our ideas or in what we as a school are doing, I can get other people to buy in. And I don't say that that's hucksterism or showmanship or smoke and mirrors necessarily, but projecting confidence does earn other people's enlisting in what you're doing. So, and that's real and valid. And I also think the flip side of that is that we as leaders aren't so great at figuring out how to model vulnerability in a healthy way. So if you think about it, if I am the principal of a school and I'm continually cringing and on the verge of tears all the time, and I speak in such a mild voice, and I always have, I'm slouched over and I can't even look people in the eye. If I have that level of lack of confidence, people might wonder if I'm in the right profession. But what if I'm somewhere in between the middle? I'm not totally invulnerable and pristine and perfect in my day ideas all the time, but I'm not cringing and wincing. Most people are in the middle of those two things, right? But what is a healthy way of saying, guys, I'm entering a totally new phase of my leadership career, or this is something I've never dealt with before, or I'm not 100% sure that this idea will work, but we have to do something. And I think we don't have a lot of models for how to express vulnerability without being perceived as maybe lack of confidence in the wrong way, right? And we just don't see leaders doing that. We see the blustering, we see the, I think, pushiness of this will work, get on board, we got this, and that's all we have. And that's we're setting ourselves up for failure, I think, either way.
You know, something resonated with me. What you said earlier before we hit record was, I needed this book 15 years ago. And I think we write the things or the books that we need. So for me, this book was more than a book. It was a mirror, right? It was a reminder that we do not have to lead from a place of perfection, that our doubt isn't something that we fix, but it's something we have to listen to. You know, you wrote, doubt is a natural feeling, not an illness to be treated. That line stopped me in my tracks. It really resonated with me. We've all had times where we've told ourselves these stories that weren't real, narratives that were rooted in fear, not fact. And instead of staying grounded in what we could do, we get stuck in reflecting on what we hadn't done yet. So I think that I like what you're saying about that place from the middle because we are human, right? We are leaders, but we're still human. And we're not here as leaders to have all the answers, but to continue to ask questions so that we can problem find and problem solve with people because we don't have to do this work alone. We can certainly invite people to the table to have that seat at the table with us to have those conversations. And I think that's where everyone can meet you in that middle. Because if we don't do that and we don't include others in the conversation, as you say so beautifully in your book, right? Getting others on board with you for this work, it's going to be hard and it's going to be isolating, as you said before.
Yeah, and I think one of the tricks about leadership, especially educational leadership, is that it is so isolating, naturally. And when you think about a typical school, right, teachers naturally bond together, as they should, right? There are many teachers, and you rely on your professional learning community, you rely on your department, you rely on your mentor, and teachers assume the best of each other, right? Again, as they should. And so it's very easy to make friends as a teacher in your school. But so many schools and departments have one leader, one administrator. And so you could be the only person with your job title in the school. And when you throw in the unfortunate but almost inevitable adversarial relationship between teachers and administrators, that's even more isolating. And so as an admin, yeah, you come in and suddenly people don't assume the best of you. They don't go out of their way to help or make friends with you. And then it puts even more pressure on you to be everything, right? So you're modeling vulnerability perfectly, but you're also projecting enough confidence so people will follow. And you know the answers to every question. And you're a great community builder, even though the community is further away from you than it's ever been. And I think when you look at all the things that you have to do as a leader, then if you feel little nagging doubts, you wonder, am I broken? Am I missing a part? The mere fact that I'm feeling this maybe is a sign that I can't do all of these things because other leaders look so confident all the time. They seem like they have it together. And I remember a leader who did, and we just get in our heads with this spiraling. The doubt itself must be the sign that I should go off and do something else with my life because clearly I can't do all of these things that leaders are expected to do.
Some follow the noise. Bloomberg follows the money. Because behind every headline is a bottom line. Whether it's the funds fueling AI or crypto's trillion-dollar swings, there's a money side to every story. And when you see the money side, you understand what others miss. Get the money side of the story. Subscribe now at Bloomberg.com.
Sure. I mean, you say the mere fact that you're interrogating your fitness to lead suggests that you are a reflective practitioner, eager to grow to your full potential. Incompetent people don't do that. So I don't know. That really hit home for me because we don't question ourselves because we're incapable. We do it because we care deeply, because we're aware of what's at stake. And because we want to do right by those we serve. And I'll never forget that first, you just took me back to a time, my first year of being an administrator when I was an assistant principal. I remember walking into the faculty room and I remember everyone kind of stopped and looked at me and I was like, oh no, are they
Yeah.
talking about me? Are they not liking
Scared.
that I'm here? And I said to my principal at the time, I said, oh my goodness, this is what happened. And he said, nope, Lauren. He says, it's the seat you're in. It's not you. It's
Yeah.
just the seat that you're in. And it was the first time I felt that loss of the camaraderie of teachers. And I felt a little bit alone in that moment. I'm not gonna lie. So what you said, it really resonated.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you turn into a different species as soon as you become an administrator, and that in and of itself helps to spiral your doubt, because then you wonder, well, are people treating me differently because I'm being too hubristic? Are they treating me differently because I'm mean? You know, do they not trust me? Did I do something to lose their trust? And then, yeah, you can overanalyze. And then, yeah, your principal's advice, if it's just the seat you're in, it's not you, I think was spot on. But you want to talk about doubts that you have to combat. I mean, the way people treat you stirs up everything. But yeah, I think in terms of the mere fact that you can question your own competence is a sign that you're trying to grow and trying to achieve. That's the important thing to remember, because it's very easy to look at that self-doubt and interpret it as a sign that you're not cut out for things. But I actually think it means the opposite. It means you're reflective, you
Yes.
know, and just for context, I'm sure everyone has known a leader, unfortunately, in their time, who was so single-visioned, so on their own path, so completely convinced that they were right in all situations and that anyone who went against them was completely wrong. And if you think about that person, were they a great leader? You know, was that total self-assurance and that unwillingness to reflect, was that good? And obviously, no. I mean, I think about the person who's coming to my mind, and no, I wouldn't want to work for them ever again, you know? And just that's a good reminder to me of everyone should have a little bit of, call it reflection, call it self-doubt, call it self-quest, call it whatever you want, but that little voice that makes you question yourself.
That's powerful. And actually, that's a good segue to a quote I want to share from the introduction, which, you know, as I was reading the introduction, and I may have texted this to Lauren, I think I ended up reading the introduction. You know, I know I previewed the book, and I, you know, loved the preview, and then I always like to do a deeper dive, and I ended up rereading the introduction literally four times. Because and I think that's the gift of your voice, the authenticity of how you frame things as you're framing now. I'll just read here, and I quote, "Full disclosure, this book isn't a compendium of academic research. It's a practical field guide based on my experience. I wrote it because I'm weary of being told how to handle the pressure of my job by people who have never actually done my job." And I sticky noted, I don't have the sticky note, but I remember writing a sticky note like, where did that come from? And I'm just kind of curious. And we, you know, I, you know, we're all professional here. We don't want to name names, but I'm just, that one hit home, because I have been in that situation myself. I'd love for you to expand on that.
Sure. A lot of this actually wasn't inspired by anyone within education talking about imposter syndrome. I think it was the larger narrative around imposter syndrome. So if you look at the writing that's out there, it is so surface level. The idea of, oh, you get daily affirmations, you know, and if you look in the mirror and tell yourself you're enough and you got this, and everything is so rah rah, glitter, confetti, but it doesn't actually cut to, I think, the mental gymnastics that you maybe need to do in order to kind of work through your self-doubt. It's all very band-aid on top of an issue. And I cannot think of anything more patronizing to a professional who is in a leadership position, who is trying to change hearts and minds, who is trying to make education better for our children, than to say, Oh, just do some daily affirmations. And I know that affirmations help some people, and that's wonderful, but I also don't know any educational leaders who personally use affirmations. And I can't think to myself that looking in the mirror and saying, "You got this, girlfriend, you're enough," would ever actually help me, because I might not be enough. Every single day, I make mistakes, and there are situations that I am not enough for yet. And adding the yet helps, I guess, but I don't think that just putting a band-aid on things, or just doing more mantras, or just, giving yourself little pep talks rather than actually learning how to do the things that you don't currently know how to do is useful. So yeah, I don't love our conversation around imposter syndrome and self-doubt. I think it ignores the fact that all of us are still learners, and rather makes us say that we are things that we are not, just to make ourselves feel better. But I don't feel better from telling myself glib affirmations. I feel better when I do better.
Expedia and Visit Scotland invite you to come step into centuries of history that await in Scotland. Castles steeped in legend, walk along cobblestone streets. Come share the warmth of stories passed down through generations. This is a place with a past that is fully present today and all yours to explore. Plan your Scottish escape today at expedia.com/visit Scotland.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree with you more. I don't use positive affirmations. It hasn't worked for me. I tried it, but what does work for me is that same doubt that we have living inside of ourselves can also push us towards growth. So I've really tried to harness the doubt that lives within, as an opportunity, as painful as it might feel sometimes, that feeling of disappointment, that feeling of fear, as painful as it is, I always say, "Lauren, I talk to myself, you're uncomfortable right now, and this is what does work for me. You're uncomfortable right now, but you're growing." Because if you're living in this place of comfort all the time, which never happens in leadership and never happens in education, because we're dealing with a lot of people, kids, educators, our communities, we're all human beings who come with different perspectives, and different personal biases, right? That's what makes our world so beautiful in so many ways. And I think it's learning how to navigate, those experiences, and that push us towards becoming better. But we have to let ourselves do that. We have to let ourselves live that a little bit. And that comes with that modeling of vulnerability that you were talking about. And part of that growth is really naming what we're feeling, naming those narratives we're telling ourselves. And, the ones rooted in fear, the ones that keep us feeling small. Right? Those are the same ones that can help us reclaim who we are and who we're continuously aspiring to be.
And I think focusing on the things that we can control as vehicles for growth. So, for instance, I think a healthy way to model vulnerability is talking openly with your team about, "I don't know A, B, and C, and I can't guarantee X, Y, and Z. But I know that I'm here, and I know I'm a good listener, and I know I will listen to all of your concerns, ideas, whatever, and we'll get through it together." Like, to me, that's a healthy modeling of vulnerability that doesn't rely on something glib that's without of your control, or that doesn't, I don't know, portray you as someone who's going to fall apart. Like, to me, that type of modeling of vulnerability balances the confidence with the acknowledgement that I don't know everything and can't control everything.
Well stated. Is, for depending on what part of the country that you're in, school is starting or about to start. For me, my school year with students started this past Monday. I know Lauren goes back to her district on Monday, and there are either leaders right now who are starting their first gig. There are also leaders right now who are either at the end or in the twilight of their career. And there's always some level of doubt and fear and anxiety and those things. And in some cases with leaders, there's a lot riding on what we have to do this year. I always love the idea of back to school being reset. Okay, I get a chance to start over again. I get a chance to make a different move or make a different turn. But yet there is some level of expectation from on high, and some of that expectation too, just knowing school leaders, because we are very driven, and we do, as much as we say it's progress, not perfection, it's perfection. Okay. That's what it is. That's what we shoot for. And that therein lies all kinds of potholes there. But is there a particular chapter in your book, Elizabeth, that you would want a leader to kind of land on right now at this time? You know, of course, read the introduction, go to chapter one. But if you were kind of giving any kind of advice for leaders that are starting at the beginning of their career, or as a school leader, or they're in the midst of, what would be an ideal place to kind of start?
Yeah, I think the situation that I experienced the most in my early days of leadership was chapter four, the struggling salesperson. This basically could have been the you've worked in some chair or something like that. And at that level, you're not really making many big picture decisions, but those decisions are getting handed down to you. But you're the schmo that has to sell them to your staff. And so I found myself again and again in the situation of defending somebody else's choice or rolling out somebody else's ideas or programs, even though I wasn't there at the ground level when they were being made. Why would I be? But someone hands something to you and now you're getting 100 questions, you're getting pushback, you know, from your department. And so then you don't want to be the complete, I don't know, unlistening, unfeeling brick wall and just say, this is the way we have to do it. But you don't necessarily know why certain things are in place and you're struggling to defend them and justify them. And there's a lot of questions you don't know the answers to. And, you know, especially if it's something you just don't agree with, you don't know how to sell it. So I think that's probably the most common one. And the start of the year is when all this stuff happens, right? You have the summer administrator meeting and the central office people hand you a bunch of stuff and you're sort of like, I have 3 days to figure out how to sell this to staff. So yeah, I would say that's probably the one to start with. And then also,
girl, winter is so last season. And now spring's got you looking at pictures of tank tops with hungry eyes. Your algorithm is feeding you cutoffs. You're thirsty for the sun on your shoulders. That perfect hang on the patio sundress. Those sandals you can wear all day and all night. And you've had enough of shopping from your couch. Done hoping it looks anything like the picture when you tear open that envelope? It's time for a little in-person spring treat. It's time for a trip to Ross. Work your magic.
Just being really, really practical with yourself as to what you can achieve when you're in that situation, because I think it's very unrealistic for any first year administrator or early career leader to assume that by August 20th, I'm definitely going to get a parade in my honor because of how good of a job I did selling this. That, like, that's just not going to happen. So just temper your expectations, get through it one day at a time, have a strategic plan for yourself, and you'll be okay.
Beautifully said.
Yeah, you know, it's what really resonated with me. One of the many things that resonated with me is you say a line called sell the collaboration as much as the plan.
Yeah.
And I thought that was so brilliant. Again, you know, I think what we do in education is so important that it cannot be a one-man show. There can't be somebody out there making all of these important decisions. And it is a true shared responsibility and collective effort. You know, when something is not going well, that can't be the responsibility of one person. When something's going really well, that also can't be the responsibility of one person, right? It's a number of people that make that happen. And it builds trust and buy-in, but it also reminds people that we were all part of something really special and really important. All keeping kids at the heart of this decision making. And, I think something that I wrote about in that blog post and reflecting on what you were saying was that we kind of have to pause and say, when self-doubt is creeping in, that this is my awareness speaking. It's not a weakness. I'm just aware of what is going on. And to reframe it as a sign that we care deeply and that we're growing, right? And Sean, I love that question that you just asked, Elizabeth, because yes, we need to support our new administrators and our new teachers and new educators. But I also think of the educators a lot that are in the middle. You know, they're not our veteran, they're not our new, but they're our seasoned leaders, right? Who still have a long journey left in their career. And yet so many of these leaders and educators are saying to me recently, Lauren, I feel like I'm brand new. There's so much that has changed and evolved in education, you know, new curriculum. There are new initiatives. And I've never led this type of priority before. I have not learned how to teach a curriculum this way. And so even though I'm a seasoned teacher or a seasoned leader, you know, I feel like that self-doubt is creeping in and it shouldn't. So I think the people in the middle of their careers right now are ones that we need to also take under our wings and support as well. And we can't forget about those people.
Yes, absolutely. Having, you know, I guess I would say I'm in the twilight of my career, and you know, we tend to forget that very group. And I think that's a pivotal group to support and to empower. And I gotta say to you both, one of the things that I really love about both of you is in your writing and in your practice, in your conversation, is the impeccable way that you have with words in writing and in conversation. And there is an art to that, I believe. And in some cases, that's something that is natural. That is something that is, or may not be. But it all, the implicit kind of foundation for that is self-reflection. And you talk a lot about that, Elizabeth, in your book, about this kind of interior self-monologue. Even in the anecdotes or the mini case studies that prelude each chapter, which I really enjoyed. And I hated seeing those case studies ending because I wanted more of the story. You're just such a masterful storyteller. But I would say, Lauren and Elizabeth, to you both, how I think that's important for leaders to have, to kind of combat that self-doubt, that notion of reflection of words, reflection of thoughts, reflection of expression. How do you all do that?
Well, I will kick us off by saying that my self-talk is atrocious. I am not a good example for how to talk to yourself. So in terms of my internal monologue, I don't know that I always practice what I preach and give myself the grace that I should. That said, no, I think maybe I have a combination of natural ability, having always been a reader and a writer myself. So it's pretty easy, I think, for me to say what I'm thinking in precise terms. I think where I struggle is, again, we were talking a little bit before we got started here, some of the common, I guess, party lines that we're meant to say in education are the things that actively bother me. There are so many things that either we must say or we must not say. And I don't like feeling restricted like that. I do really prefer to, as professionally and eloquently and respectfully and caringly as possible, just say what it is I'm thinking. That's what I would like to do.
So for me, you know, Elizabeth, we're a lot alike in that way, is that I'm not always very kind to myself. And I know that, and it bothers me. And I think the first people we need to be kind to is ourselves, because if we can't be kind to ourselves, how are we supposed to be ready to support other people when we're telling ourselves these narratives, right? So I think that's a natural human response, but I also think it comes from being so reflective and caring so deeply. And I think that's what makes us also such avid readers and writers, because we're always looking to learn more. We're always looking to grow and then reflect on that through our writing. One of the things I do when it comes to my writing, Sean, and I know we've talked about that before, is I'm always thinking about what's going on in my world right now in education. And I'm always looking for books that can reaffirm my thinking a little bit, but push my thinking as well. Books inside of education and outside. I listen to a lot of podcasts as well. I'm a big fan of Audible. I read a lot of articles. So what I do is for myself, I keep a note section in my smartphone and I jot down whatever quotes are resonating with me from different books, different podcasts, things like that. And then I'll simply go about my days. I don't force anything. Things happen. I pushed out a blog this morning about two students, former students that I ran into in the same week this week. And I didn't plan for that to happen. One was at my son's basketball game that I ran into a former student. The other was at CVS Pharmacy. The young gentleman was working there, and it turns out we came face to face. So I use those stories, whether it's happening in my personal life, whether it's happening at work, to take what I've learned in those books, in those podcasts, take what's going on in my life, and then reflect on that. So it's kind of like bridging theory with practice. And then what are some actionable things I can do to implement tomorrow to not only help myself, but help others around me grow a little bit and learn from that. So that's kind of my approach. And that's evolved over time as I've been writing every week.
Wow, at that I love that, and for you both, I mean, again, the foundation is reflection, and being intentional with that, and working those reflective muscles, regardless of what path you decide to take, whether it's writing, whether it's battling Chicago traffic like Elizabeth was earlier. I think that's a key component for leaders. I mean, at least for me. That I've learned over the past couple of years, since my little health and mental health crisis. I also think too, I think the more that and I want to kind of go back to something that Elizabeth has previously shared is, there's like these codes in school leadership that we follow. And some of those, well, no, we can't talk about that. We can't show that vulnerability. We can't, say that we don't know, because again, there's this, I believe that there is this myth of school leadership that is so detrimental, that's manifested on so many different levels. And that may be another blog post or book for any one of the three of us here. But I think the more that we can lean in and raise those things, so and it becomes normal. So when I talk about very openly, and I didn't at first because I was afraid to, about, hey, I go to therapy, and there are things that I have to do to take care of me and to make sure that I'm at a good place personally, and then for my family and the faculty that I serve. And I remember sharing this with just a couple of weeks ago at an opening faculty meeting about a and I wrote about it, and I didn't think I was going to go there either, but I talked about how this guy on an airplane that I was flying with, a passenger seated next to me, he was having a panic attack, and I deal with panic, and so I started talking with him and reminding him of his strategies because I felt bad, and I shared that with the faculty, and I said, yeah, I do strategies because I suffer from panic and
eczema is unpredictable. but you can flare less with Ebglyss, a once-monthly treatment for moderate to severe eczema. After an initial four-month or longer dosing phase, about 4 in 10 people taking Ebglyss achieved itch relief and clear or almost clear skin at 16 weeks. And most of those people maintained skin that's still more clear at 1 year with monthly dosing.
Ebglyss, lebrikizumab, LBKZ, a 250 milligram per 2 milliliter injection, is a prescription medicine used to treat adults and children 12 years of age and older who weigh at least 88 pounds or 40 kilograms with moderate to severe eczema, also called atopic dermatitis, that is not well controlled with prescription therapies used on the skin or topicals, or who cannot use topical therapies. Ebglyss can be used with or without topical corticosteroids. Don't use if you're allergic to Ebglyss. Allergic reactions can occur that can be severe. Eye problems can occur. Tell your doctor if you have new or worsening eye problems. You should not receive a live vaccine when treated with Ebglyss. Before starting Ebglyss, tell your doctor if you have a parasitic infection.
Ask your doctor about Ebglyss and visit ebglyss.lilly.com or call 1-800-LILY-RX or 1-800-545-5979.
And I talked to somebody about it. And I could see the temperature of the room change a little bit or shift a little bit. Not like everybody gave me a big kumbaya, you know, hug, but there were a couple of folks afterwards that said, hey, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate you sharing that you go to therapy. And then that led to either them sharing something about their life and how they deal with different things. And I have found that the more that we talk about this, the more, I mean, I love the title of this book because we have all had that moment. I sometimes add expletives around the title of your book, Elizabeth, where when I reach those moments, am I effing cut out for this or whatever, you know, but I think the title alone of your book, and us sharing, whether it's through blogging or writing and willing to lean into that vulnerability, makes the space a little bit better for somebody else who is suffering and is in agony. So I'm just so grateful for this book. I needed it. I didn't need it 15 years ago. I needed it 17, 18 years ago, you know, so it's how long I've been in the gig, but I'm just so grateful for what you've brought to the world in your second book, Elizabeth.
Well, thank you so much. And yeah, I think as you talk about, you know, modeling vulnerability by being open about being in therapy or panic attacks, same, by the way, it's a good reminder that sometimes you can change culture just one person at a time through your interactions. So my own thing that I was thinking of as you were talking about that, I had a staff member years ago, and she was, it was Sunday, and she was about to have major, major surgery Monday. And she's doing work Sunday and texting me about it, like, oh, I did this thing, I did that thing, and I want, and I texted her back, why are you doing work on Sunday? You're about to have massive surgery tomorrow. Please focus on yourself. And then months later, she goes, you know, no boss has ever told me to work less on the weekend or to step away from work. And I said, well, you know, you were about to have a pretty big surgery, but also Sunday and Saturday are there for a reason. So I don't work on the weekends unless it's like a true emergency, but if I was about to have big surgery on Monday, you better believe I would have spent that time with my family. So please do that. And it was like no one had ever said anything that life-changing to her before. And it's such a simple thing, but it stuck with this person for a long time. And so I think, you know, to your point, sometimes when you give people permission to be a person instead of a worker bee, that's all it takes.
Wow, that's powerful. And it's those you know, Lauren and I talk about like those simple moments and those small wins, and I know, Lauren, you've written so eloquently about the power of moments, taking a little bit away from the Heath guys. Mm-hmm. But again, those, if we lean into that moment, It does ripple and it does resonate, and I really do think it can restore and help others, because it is, you don't know what folks are carrying, right, Lauren?
we don't know. Nobody wears a sign on their head saying how they're feeling or what they went through or what they're going through today. That's why we have to be kind to everyone, because we never know. But I also just want to thank Elizabeth for writing this book. Am I cut out for this? And I just want to leave Elizabeth and your audience, Sean, just with this thought. When we have a voice that wonders, am I cut out for this? It's often the one that's already leading with heart and mind, and you're not alone. You're already on your way, and I believe in you, and I will continue to believe in myself too.
Thank you, Lauren. I'm so grateful for you, and thank you for sharing that. Elizabeth, what is next? I know when we spoke earlier, when we were trying to schedule this, I know you were talking about some your writing taking a possible different turn. I don't know if you've explored that avenue just yet.
Yeah, I've thought about the thing that I've been thinking about the most, actually, at this point, has been the idea of jadedness, because I think that's a taboo topic. It's one of these words that everybody throws around as though we know what it means, and we all know it's bad, and we all know that we should judge people who are jaded in education because that's the right answer. But it does seem to me that our attitude around the jaded educator, whether that's a teacher, an administrator, a school psychologist, whoever, is very much condemnation, dismiss them, get them out of the school as quickly as possible. But is that ignoring the reason that we have so many people who are jaded in our system? Because it's a large percentage, right? We're generally not talking about one or two people, but more than that in any given school. And so, if our response is, oh, just get rid of them, instead of examine what systemically is causing people to maybe tip into jadedness, I think we could have a richer conversation around it. And as a person who's in the middle of my career, it's something I'm very seriously interested in, not only for myself, but also just I want to look at the system of education and see what we're not exploring or acknowledging about jadedness.
Oh my gosh. Lauren, I saw your wheels turning. I can't wait for this. This is wow.
I mean, I haven't really thought about it, so I need to actually process that a little bit more, and I will be
Yes.
after this conversation. I'm speechless actually right now.
It's such a complicated topic
It
that
is.
there's I don't have a book deal or anything for this, but just if you're asking like what am I thinking of, that's what I've been grappling with because it is a complicated topic that we treat like it's simple, and I don't like that.
That's powerful. So I man, I may just need to bring the podcast back. Or I don't know, just conversations with Elizabeth and Lauren, because I'm so enriched right now. And that's a whole other rabbit hole we can go down. Wow. That's heavy. But well, I look forward to where that goes and where that lands. And I am so grateful, Elizabeth, for your time, for conversation as you have battled Chicago traffic, and hopefully you're going to get to your de continue to get to your destination safely and soundly. My friends, the book is "Am I Cut Out for This?" by Elizabeth Dampth, an educational leader's guide to navigating self-doubt. Comes to us from our folks at ISTE and ASCD, just came out this year. I had the great opportunity to be at the ISTE ASCD conference in San Antonio, and one of the highlights for me was the bookstore and seeing your book proudly displayed on the shelf. And Elizabeth, I will admit I may have pressured some people into picking up the book. I was lingering around and people were looking for whatever it was, AI, and I don't know. And I said, "Hey, Elizabeth Dampf, you gotta pick this book up, man. This is worth your while." So I was a bit of a huckster out there in San Antonio.
Well,
So.
thank you. I hope you were wearing a sandwich board and everything with a big arrow to the stand.
I was,
Yeah.
and then I
And we
would.
have to mention real quick that Sean was named the, I know, 20 to watch by ASCD and ISTE, and
Yeah.
shout out to Sean.
Awesome.
Woo-hoo! So awesome.
Congrats.
Thank you very much, Lauren. I always appreciate your endorsements and your support. You're a true blue friend. So thank you for that. I was very, very humbled to be a part of that. And actually, and finally met in person our great friend, mutual friend Megan Lawson, and great to spend time with her and
Yeah.
so many great folks there. It really was a great and meaningful conference, and I'm looking forward to more ahead of the horizon. And both of you, at some point, either keynoting or presenting at any one of those conferences. I want to manifest that. So I know Lauren, you spoke last year at ASCD's Leadership Summit. So I'm just manifesting that for you both, and I'll be in the audience with my sandwich board and copies of both of your books and URLs. Promoting you both. So thank you so much, Lauren. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. This has just been just a long time in coming, and a great treat, and a great way to conclude the summer session of the podcast, where I will put this back on a hiatus so that I can spend some time writing the second book and try to beat any Lauren's accountability reminders as that will be coming out in 2026. So to all of our listeners, thank you, and viewers, thank you so much for tuning in to the Principal Liner Notes podcast. I'll be sure to have all of the links to Elizabeth's work and Lauren's work. You should follow them both, purchase their books, follow their blogs, and what's great about them both is they are very interactive. That's how Elizabeth and I met. I remember reading her blog post a few years ago on ASCD, and I wrote her an email and got a response back, and we've been friends since. So very grateful for both of you all being just so generous with your time and your expertise. As I do sign off, don't forget to share with the world your dreams, your visions, your ideas, because the world needs them, and you help make the world a better place. This is Sean Gaylord with my two great friends and bandmates, Lauren Kaufman and Elizabeth Damp, signing off for the Principal Liner Notes podcast. Catch you on the flip side.